This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The estranged wife of Lesotho's incoming prime minister has been shot dead, just days ahead of the new leader's swearing in. His party recently swept to power after five unstable years that included vicious infighting and political violence. And now the party says it is worried the violence may return.
That's VOA's Anita Powell reporting from Johannesburg. Details coming up. Also, the attack yesterday on two restaurants in central Mogadishu has left a total of 30 people dead. A grenade explosion in Burundi's capital has left one person dead and nine others injured. And UNICEF says child poverty and hunger are widespread in 41 of the world's richest countries. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Somali security forces ended the Al-Shabaab siege of a Mogadishu restaurant early today after battling the militants for almost 11 hours. The latest figures say 30 people were killed, including 9 civilians, 6 Al-Shabaab militants and 5 soldiers. The commander of police in the Hodan district of the city told VOA Somali that special security forces launched a major operation just before 6 a.m. local time. The attack started last evening with an explosion from a car bomb that detonated outside two restaurants, Pisa House and Posh Streets, causing massive damage. Witnesses said the gunmen entered Posh Streets and then proceeded to the Pisa House, where they put up a fierce resistance against the security forces. In other news on Somalia, the UN Security Council has unanimously adopted a resolution to extend the UN political mission there until March 2018. In doing so, the Council also condemned attacks by Al-Shabaab militants. The Associated Press reports the resolution calls on the mission to support the government's effort to fight corruption, review the constitution, and develop effective political and judicial systems. The Security Council also expressed grave concern at what it called the credible and renewed risk of famine in Somalia due to drought and conflict. The estranged wife of Lesotho's incoming prime minister has been shot dead just days ahead of the new leader's swearing in. His party recently swept to power after five unstable years that included vicious infighting and political violence. And now the party says it is worried the violence may return. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
Tom Tabane will take office Friday with a heavy heart, his spokesman says, after his estranged wife was shot dead Wednesday night outside the capital of the tiny southern African nation. Lipolelo Tabane's killing has sparked fears that Lesotho is returning to political violence. Tabane is taking a second turn at being prime minister after his last term ended suddenly in 2014, when he fled to neighboring South Africa because he said the army was trying to kill him. Tabane recently returned his All-Basotho Convention Party to power in a snap poll held earlier this month. It was the third election in 5 years, after bitter infighting brought down the previous two coalition governments. Moiketsi Majuru, the spokesman for Tabane's party, told VOA that the police have yet to name a suspect and that the party is trying not to speculate on what may have happened. Lipolelo Tabane died on the scene from her wounds. A friend who was traveling with her is being treated at a hospital.
It's when a death like this occurs, it raises a lot of ire and a lot of speculation. And of course, it's our responsibility as the incoming government to ensure that we don't over-speculate and let the law enforcement agencies take the lead in investigating these deaths.
Majuru, who is one of the party's 48 new lawmakers recently voted into power, urged Basotho citizens to try to remain calm, even if they, like him, are rattled.
After the reporting of his death, I thought things were going to be reasonably smooth, but this tells me that nothing should be taken for granted going forward. It sends signals that we are back to 2014 again, when it was not easy to govern.
That's because the military has long been tightly entwined with this nation's political woes. The army led a 1986 coup to push out a long-serving government. In this century, Lesotho's military has been involved in a number of political actions, including the action that ended Thabane's last term after just 2 years in office. One of Thabane's strongest campaign promises was that he could embark on a set of serious reforms to bring the nation's security forces into line and keep them from interfering in political matters. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Burundi, a grenade explosion in the capital has left one person dead and 10 others injured. AFP quotes the mayor of Bujumbura as saying the grenade was thrown among a group of people having a beer near the bus station in Musaga. Musaga is an opposition stronghold in southern Bujumbura. Many protests were held there in 2015 after President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. Critics called it unconstitutional. Since then, political violence has claimed hundreds of lives, while hundreds of thousands have left for neighboring countries. In related news, UN investigators say Burundi security forces continue to abduct, torture and kill people with near impunity. A commission of inquiry has collected testimony from nearly 500 people since September. The chairman says the panel is struck by the particular cruel and brutal nature of the violations described. Burundi government officials strongly deny the allegations. Malnourished children in the greater Upper Nile region of South Sudan will be getting emergency medical care. Lutheran World Relief says it will soon begin providing them with 24-hour life-saving treatment. A severe food crisis is being fueled by extreme drought in the area. Compounding the situation is ongoing conflict that has killed over 50,000 people and displaced nearly 2 million since December 2013. The NGO is joining another faith-based group, IMA World Health, to run three treatment centers in the area where there are no emergency medical facilities. Carrie Tanhill is an emergency program manager for Lutheran World Relief and has just returned from South Sudan. She spoke with Kim Lewis about the treatment centers.
These are stabilization centers, is sort of what they're called. And we're going to be setting up three of them in three counties in the greater Upper Nile area. And they're really going to be focused on children and pregnant and lactating women, since those people tend to be the most vulnerable groups during famine or a food crisis. And really, these patients who are accessing them are going to be sort of the most malnourished out of the group. They'll receive 24-hour care until they maintain a healthy weight and they're better. A lot of the patients who are coming in here actually have secondary illnesses like malaria as well. So we'll make sure that they maintain a healthy weight and that they're healthy in general.
So what are the biggest concerns in treating the most vulnerable, such as women and children and babies and pregnant women?
Some of the concerns are that they can't access the centers in general, which is why Lutheran World Relief has really decided that this intervention is the most useful, because in this area, there's actually only four stabilization centers that are servicing a really large population. So that's why if we build three more, then hopefully that'll ease some of the access to them. So not only are the people who are going to be using these centers coming from our partner IMA's clinics that they have already set up, a part of this project is doing door-to-door outreach in the community to make sure no one really goes untouched.
When will the centers be open?
The centers, I believe, are going to be open hopefully within the next month. The project just started June 1st, so we have to do some procurement to set up the actual clinics themselves. These clinics are made out of prefabricated materials, which thankfully are already located in Juba. So it's just a matter of doing the actual procurement and then airlifting them out to the sites where the clinics will be set up. Hopefully within the next month, that will be all completed and they'll be open and ready to receive patients.
Are you getting the cooperation that you need on the ground, given the instability in the area?
Fortunately, Lutheran World Relief and its partner, IMA World Health, is already working in that area. So they're quite entrenched. You know, we can't say for definite, but for right now, there is pretty extensive cooperation going on. Anything can happen in South Sudan. It's just the nature of working in a complex humanitarian crisis. But for now, we're quite hopeful that there shouldn't be any interruptions.
How many people will these centers serve total?
So total during the length of the project, which runs from June until the end of September, we're hoping to reach about 90,000 people.
I understand that you all also will have outpatient services. Can you tell us about these services?
This sort of goes back to the other clinics that IMA is currently running. One of the things that we'll be doing in addition to creation of these stabilization centers is also a pretty large purchase of medication. Medication is really hard to get funding for, unfortunately. So this is one of the ways that we're able to fill a gap and hopefully purchase a big bulk order of medication that is not only going to help with nutrition needs, but also things like malaria and other chronic diseases that are affecting these people, which is making them even more sick.
Carrie Tannehill is an emergency program manager for Lutheran World Relief. She spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Baltimore, Maryland. Past the hour, you are listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Desert locusts are usually harmless. However, when conditions are just right, they can swarm and destroy crops and pasture land. If things get really bad, a locust plague could put millions of people at risk for hunger. But now, a satellite early warning system is being developed to better predict when swarms might occur. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
The European Space Agency and the UN Food and Agriculture Organization will use satellites to monitor soil moisture and green vegetation. The ideal conditions for desert locusts to swarm are drought, followed by good rains and rapid vegetation growth. FAO's Keith Cressman says satellites can make a big difference when the alarm is sounded.
At the moment, we can provide early warning of outbreaks perhaps 1 month in advance, but normally that's only a couple of weeks. The new product will allow us to certainly double that time.
The senior locust forecasting officer says countries will have more time to get ready.
That means to mobilize the necessary teams in the field to intensify survey efforts to identify all the potential infestations that might be present. And it also allows them extra time to organize the necessary control operations.
It can make the difference between a swarm that's localized and a plague that's not. Between 2003 and 2005, locusts destroyed cereal crops in West Africa and damaged about 90% of legumes and pasture. That put the lives of 8 million people at risk. The FAO says it took 13 million liters of pesticide, costing $600 million, to bring the plague under control. The FAO says one square kilometer-sized swarm is made up of about 40 million locusts. They can eat the same amount of food in one day as 35,000 people. Cressman outlines the stages leading to a plague.
A locust plague doesn't develop overnight. It starts initially from very small localized outbreaks in a particular country. And if those outbreaks are not detected or controlled in time, and if there's sufficient rainfall and good conditions, that outbreak can then extend to a much larger, what we call upsurge, that can affect a number of countries or region. And similarly, if that upsurge is not controlled and conditions continue to be favorable, can then turn into a plague that can infect an entire continent, for example.
Images provided by the joint FAO European Space Agency project would come from satellites such as the one assigned to the Soil Moisture and Ocean Salinity mission.
The satellite images will show those areas where the soil is sufficiently moist enough to allow desert locust breeding. This is the stage in which the locus numbers increase. And when locus numbers increase, then there's that possibility for them to change their normally solitarious behavior to that of a gregariousness and to start to form these groups that then turn into hopper bands and adult swarms that cause the devastation.
The summer breeding season begins in late June or early July, mainly in the West Africa Sahel region and Sudan, and along the India-Pakistan border. Cressman says desert locusts are well adapted already to climate change. He says rising temperatures allow the insects to mature faster, giving them more time to breed. Also, climate change forecasts call for more and heavier rainfall in desert areas, creating good conditions for breeding. What's not clear is climate change's effect on wind. Desert locusts travel with the wind, and changes in wind patterns could bring them to areas they've never been before. It could take up to a year to fully implement the satellite early warning system. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
There was gridlock in Johannesburg today as minibus taxi drivers protested what they called unaffordable monthly payments on their vehicles. Media reports say the drivers blocked roads and highways and threatened motorists. Parents were told to keep their children home from school for their own safety. The Associated Press reports that travelers were seen wheeling their luggage along the highway on their way to OR Tambo International Airport. The Automobile Association urged motorists to be vigilant and remain calm if threatened. A new report by the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, finds child poverty and hunger are widespread in 41 of the world's richest countries. The report says one in five children in rich countries lives in poverty, while one in eight often do not have enough to eat. Lisa Schlein reports from the launch of the report in Geneva.
The report finds high income does not necessarily lead to a good outcome for children and often serves to widen the gap between rich and poor. UN Children's Fund Chief of Social Policy and Economic Analysis, Jose Cuesta, says all 41 countries surveyed in one way or another are failing to protect the well-being of their children.
If I were to grade all countries, no one will get an A. There are good news, of course, quite a number of targets and areas. For instance, childhood learning or reductions in neonatal mortality rates. But there are also substantive gaps in some targets, such as, for instance, poverty, reduction of children, increasing inequality, increasing obesity, and worsening mental health.
The seven top-ranked countries in UNICEF's league table of 41 countries includes all the Nordic countries, Norway, Denmark, Sweden, Finland, and Iceland, as well as Germany and Switzerland. The seven countries holding up the bottom are Chile, Mexico, the United States, Bulgaria, Romania, Israel, and Turkey. Cuesta tells VOA the United States, which ranks 37th, does not perform well in areas such as poverty, hunger, good health and well-being, and quality education.
Actually, it's a surprise and it's not a surprise at the same time because consistently the U.S. is doing poorly across these 10 indicators. So it's not really one indicator driving the results here.
The report notes wealth and economic growth alone are not enough to ensure the well-being of children. UNICEF is urging rich countries to put children's needs at the heart of their policy agenda. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa has the most people living with HIV, almost 7 million. It also manages the globe's largest antiretroviral program, keeping about 4 million people alive with the drugs. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg at the South African National AIDS Conference this week. Specialists voiced their concern about the spiking rates of infections among young women, a trend reflected throughout the continent.
Among the people socializing in a tavern in Alexandra Township in Johannesburg is Karabo Sateke, who asked that VOA not give her real name. She's a slight, attractive 19-year-old in a veil of an orange dress, defying the winter chill. Satege often meets one of her partners here. He's more than double her age. Satege explains that sex with older men is sometimes rough and always without a condom. The director of the Section 27 social justice movement, Mark Hayward, says South Africa is treating HIV successfully, but he's failing to prevent new infections, reflecting a global trend.
What does it tell you about the lack of knowledge about HIV 20, 30 years into the HIV epidemic? You know, we've seen, shockingly, a decline in knowledge of HIV amongst young people. It's like we've taken our foot off the accelerator in certain respects.
He says more than 200 young women, ages 15 to 24, are infected with HIV each day in South Africa. In 2015, that demographic accounted for the largest segment of new HIV infections in South Africa and a disproportionate number of new cases in the region. Adolescent and young women made up a quarter of the new cases in sub-Saharan Africa, according to UNAIDS' most recent global report. UNAIDS says adolescent and young women in Africa are at particularly high risk for a variety of reasons, like poverty, lack of education, and violence. Like Satege, many poor young women in South Africa have transactional sexual relationships with older men who have jobs and money. The men buy them food, clothes, and gifts. Healthcare workers in South Africa say transactional sex is a key driver of the new infections among young women in the country. Haywood is at the forefront of protests to demand the government make a new weapon against HIV infection available to young women. It's a combination of antiretroviral drugs called pre-exposure prophylaxis, or PrEP. Taken correctly, the pill can prevent people from getting HIV. Haywood says the state could afford to give this to young women for free.
If you have literally tens of billions of rand being stolen every year out of different government departments, that's money that could be generating programs that reduce the vulnerability of young women. But there has to be a will.
South Africa's health minister, Aaron Motsoaledi, says he plans to provide PrEP to young women in about 2 to 3 years after educating them about the pill. It must be taken at about the same time every day and must ideally be used with condoms. But after publicly opposing President Jacob Zuma because of Zuma's alleged corruption, Motsoaledi is politically isolated, and Haywood says his innovative policies to prevent new HIV infections are likely to stall. Darren Taylor, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports and tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Vasco Volarech, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5-minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.